Hello, everyone. So do all of you speak English? Do you understand it? More or less. Okay. I speak very little Russian, but I speak a lot of English and very quickly. So if I'm going too fast, please just raise your hand and tell me to slow down. So, and I'll try to speak fairly slowly, but if I get excited, you know, who knows what's going to happen. Also, if you have any questions or you want me to repeat something or you want me to clarify something while I'm talking, feel free to interrupt me, because it's not only what I want to talk about, it's also what you want to talk about. Tour developers speak to a wide variety of people, and sometimes what they want to hear is not what we want to tell them, so please interrupt me. And if I'm messing this up by flipping my hair around, also interrupt me. All right, so my name is Erin Clark. I am a tour developer. I'm also a Debian developer, which is how I know Alexander, or Alexander, I guess is the Russian version. I mostly do packaging and build infrastructure stuff for Tor. So if you download a Tor package, say for OS X, for Linux, for Windows, then I probably made it. And now you have all met me and you can verify the trust chain all along the way. So, online anonymity. Banksy, who is a fairly famous, fairly well-known artist, once said, in the future, everyone will be anonymous for 15 minutes. And I don't know if this phrase has been translated into Russian or if it's a popular Russian phrase, but at least in English, everyone will be famous for 15 minutes is something Andy Warhol once said. But now with the internet going the way it is, the opposite. Everyone's always famous, it seems like. And so what is the Tor project? Before I get into any of the design and technical stuff, the Tor project is a charity in the United States. So we can receive donations, and we do research and development of tools of online anonymity. It's also a volunteer project. We have thousands of people running relays, running bridges, and I'll tell you more about that in a little while. And helping us work on the code. And we also have a bunch of users. We have dozens of volunteer developers at any given point. People stop by randomly to hack on stuff with us. Some stick around for years and years. And at any given time, there are between 7 and 15 paid developers, such as myself. We also have, you know, the other typical company infrastructure, like managers and directors and people who kind of try to keep the development flow going and do fundraising for us. So what is Tor? What is Tor? How many of you have heard of Tor before this talk? Cool, that's a lot of hands. How many of you have used Tor? Still a lot of hands. Okay, good. I like the way this is going already. How many of you have run a relay? All right. Yes, all right, me too. Great, so you guys know more or less what Tor is and kind of how to use it and what it's good for. Great. So it's, first of all, it's software, and this is how most users experience it, which is that they download the software, they use it as a SOX proxy, they put all of their traffic through it, and they're safe. So they think, right? But it's also a network. So when you speak of Tor, you speak of the program that you have running locally on your computer, but you're also talking about the Tor network. And the Tor network is an overlay network, which is kind of like a network on top of the regular internet. And the network is thousands of volunteers, as I already said. And Tor is also a protocol. So if you decide, you know, I don't like the way the Tor project did their Tor thing. I wanna do my own thing. I'm a not invented here kind of person. I wanna implement my own Tor. You can do that. We have a spec for it. You can go, you can read through all of the hardcore technical documentation and implement your own Tor. A lot of people have done this. There were some researchers in Germany who did this. Someone recently in Canada did this. He wanted to do a Java port. So there's a Java Tor client out there. It's free software. How many of you are really into free software? A couple of you. Okay, good. All right. I can tell by the beards who's into free software. So Tor is free software, and this is primarily because online anonymity is not a solved problem. And if you want someone to solve a problem, sometimes the best thing to do is give them all of the resources. Maybe the Tor project won't be able to solve the greater problem of online anonymity or onion routing or what have you, but there might be some really smart researchers out there who will say, you know, I really want to download this thing and make it better. And they do. We have tons of people, because it's free software, tons of researchers at universities going, downloading Tor, working on it, looking at all of the code and saying, you guys, you did this wrong right here, line 17, you need to fix it. And it's a, as I mentioned, the researchers, it's a community of researchers, developers, and relay operators. So we have tons of researchers, especially. I mean, this is a university. There might even be some people here who have researched Tor somewhat. Hi, come in. No, it's okay. We have tons of people. Basically, any anonymity or privacy conference you go to is bound to have two or three papers, at least, about Tor, at least the ones I've seen. And so Tor originally was conceptualized in the US Navy. The onion routing protocol was designed by a guy named Paul Syverson, who is actually still a researcher for the Tor project. And Roger Dingledine decided as a project that he wanted to make it into a real thing, and so he did. And so the original funding came from the US Department of Defense. And then eventually it moved. How many of you have heard of the Electronic Frontier Foundation? Okay, a lot of people, good. And so they were funding Tor for a while. And then lots of activist groups and people who are really into free speech got into Tor, and so they started funding us. Google, surprisingly, is actually really into Tor, and they fund a lot of, not a lot, but they do fund some of our development work. I usually give this quote in English, but most of you have heard of Chekhov. This is from, in English, The Lady with the Little Dog. And it's a really sweet story. How many, have you read it? Do you know it? No, because you're all like, man, we read Chekhov in school and we hate those old 19th century dudes. All right. But in the story, he's got this woman and he's in love with her, and but he can't tell anyone about it because it's his mistress and so on. And this is just about, you know, the privacy. He was really excited because he was going to go see her, and nobody knew about it in the whole world. So I forget how it goes in English now that I'm looking at it in Russian, but it looks cooler in Russian, I think. So what is anonymity, right? Anonymity, people have a lot of different ideas about what anonymity means. Am I going too fast, or it's cool? It's cool, it's okay, all right, wonderful. So it's not cryptography. A lot of people say, well, I have a VPN, you know, and I just kind of tunnel all of my stuff through there, and so, you know, so I'm safe. Well, and that's not totally incorrect, because encryption is good stuff. You want to use encryption whenever you possibly can. But if you're Alice, and you're trying to talk to Bob, someone can still see that that's what you're trying to do. And maybe Bob is just, you know, it's just my friend over here and I'm sending an email. But maybe Bob is someone that the person watching doesn't want you to talk to. Maybe Bob is CNN or something like that, and the attacker is China, and they don't want you to get information from CNN, or they don't want you to see those YouTube videos like in Turkey. So maybe you can use encryption and they won't be able to see what the contents of your message, but they can still see where you're going. And it's not just wishful thinking. There are some anonymity networks like Freenet, which use a peer-to-peer design. And the basic idea there is plausible deniability, which is that there's tons of people relaying information around this network, and so you can't prove that it was me who gave you that file. But after the 10th, 15th, 20th time saying that, you know, statistics does work. If you are caught repeatedly doing something, no matter how much plausible deniability you have, eventually someone's going to say, no, this is, you've been caught 9 out of 10 times doing this. It's not true. And there are a bunch of proxy providers who are single hop proxy providers, and you often see this for things like in a lot of circumvention tools. And you're sending all of your traffic through this one computer, and you just have to, what, trust them not to look? Privacy by policy? So you say, okay, no, and they say, well, okay, we won't look at the logs. We're not going to look. We don't even keep logs. And then you find out they do keep logs. And then they say, okay, no, we won't remember the logs. We won't look at them. It's, you know, it's okay. We promise not to tell anyone about it. And then, as we say, the promise you won't tell. Well, you can't trust them with that. There's also, I think, a concept among people who think the internet is already anonymous, because everyone's on there. If your name and your face are not associated with something you're saying, then I didn't say it. You can't prove it was me. I didn't write Aaron Clark on that angry blog post. How do you know? Well, it's actually really trivially easy to find out it was you. And so regular citizens don't want to be watched and tracked. Maybe they don't think about how much they're being watched and tracked, but most people, if you tried to follow them around all day into the bathroom, watch them while they were sleeping, eavesdrop on every conversation they had with their friends, they probably wouldn't like that. And it's not that the contents are like fundamentally incriminating, it's just that they're private. You don't want to go to the bathroom in the middle of Times Square, and you don't want people to watch everything you do on the internet either. You come in. No? Okay. And so these are just some examples of the kinds of people who might want to use something like Tor, just the kinds of people who might not want you to watch everything they're doing. And so you have, let's say you have an 8-year-old on the internet, and she just wants to go in a chat room, and you've taught her well. She knows not to give her name or her address or anything, but as soon as she joins the chat room, she broadcasts her IP address. Well, an IP address is very identifying, and a lot of people and people are getting better at identifying where exactly the IP addresses are located, because advertisers want to do very targeted advertising. And there's a lot of people who are keeping track of all of these things, every website you visit. And so those are the kinds of people who need to keep secrets. In addition to that, businesses need to keep secrets too. Let's say that you are, I'm forgetting where I'm at now. All right, so let's say you work for Alice Corp and you want to go to your competitor's website and you want to see, I don't know, like you work for IBM and you want to go to Dell. You want to go to the Dell website and see what kinds of things they're offering. Well, if they know your NetBlock, then they can obviously redirect you to a different location. And law enforcement needs anonymity too. A few of the Tor developers give talks actually to people like the FBI, who say, "Thank you. We use Tor every day to do our job," because it turns out if you go somewhere and you want to look like either an 8-year-old girl or a child pornographer, if you show up from a .mil address, which is the U.S. top-level domain for military, it's not really persuasive. People are not that easily convinced that you are either a child or a pornographer. And if you, let's say you're checking your own weblogs and you see people from the local government are checking out your website on a regular basis, well, maybe that would be an indication that you need to do something else, right? And so they have to be careful about how they give away information as well. And anonymous tips are another one. So there is, in Iraq, there is an anonymous tip line online where you can go and report if you have seen someone setting up like roadside bombs or something like that. Except if you go to the local internet cafe and someone is monitoring your traffic because they keep all of the logs, that's not real anonymous, especially a lot of internet cafes require you to show an ID and sign in and give other identifying details. In China, supposedly, they have video cameras that they keep turned on all of the computers. And we're told that someone every morning goes in and turns the video camera back around and nobody returns it. But if you have someone videotaping everything you're doing, in addition to tracking the logs, it's not real anonymous. Even if the US government doesn't know your name, maybe the people on the other side, maybe they can keep track of who you're reporting these anonymous tips to. And governments need anonymity too, actually. I mean, this was originally conceived as a US government project because what happened was, this guy, Paul, he had this great idea, and he said, okay, so we're gonna have this network, and they're not gonna know where we're coming from or where we're going. But if you're the only one using an anonymity network, how anonymous can you really be? Or if you're only one in a set of five people who are using an anonymity network, it's not a whole lot of plausible deniability you got going on there. And you know, so what is FBI Google for? Who knows that? Google knows. Probably the NSA knows because they keep track of everything on the internet, right? But what about people in Russia? You're Googling. Somehow advertisers in the United States are getting all of your information and reselling it to other American companies. And so it's not just, you know, we deal with a lot of sort of, I'm going to say tinfoil hat. Do you guys know this term? Yes, okay. So we talk to a lot of tinfoil hat people, people who are paranoid, and I don't mean that as a derogatory term because I think that they're right to be paranoid. And they say, well, you know, I mean, what if the NSA can watch you? Well, what if the NSA can watch you? The problem is it's a smaller issue. It's not, I mean, if the NSA is your enemy, then you have a problem already that's much larger than what Tor can address. But what about just random businesses that you don't know anything about? Are those more trustworthy? Who has that information? Maybe the government knows everything about you, but do you want the guy sitting next to you to know everything about you? Because he runs a government that, or he runs a company that runs some advertising thing and they gather tons of information? Is that, I mean, to me that seems like a bigger realistic threat that my next door neighbor could know everything about me. And in addition to that, journalists and activists need Tor for their personal safety. I mentioned early on that, and by the way, I'm sorry because I have a cold too, so I think my voice is kind of funny sounding. But I mentioned earlier that journalists and activists, we talk to a lot of them, and one of the problems that we're finding is that they're not technical. And not only do they not understand network topology and just regular computer security, but they shouldn't be expected to understand that. You know, I mean, once upon a time, bloggers were just narcissists on the internet, and now they're actually people who get arrested by governments. Because if you speak out against your government, maybe in some countries that's not a big deal, but in other countries it's a very big deal, and there are lots and lots of stories of bloggers going to jail because they spoke out. And you have to understand that most governments do have enough resources at this point, and they do take the internet seriously enough to actually monitor what you're doing. It's not just regular surveillance anymore. They could be next door with a parabolic microphone listening to everything you do. Maybe they are listening to which keys you type and they're able to reconstruct your sentences like that. But the point is that journalists and activists need it too. And as I said before, you can't get anonymity on your own. If you are part of a small anonymity set, then that is not providing you much protection. It's at best, it's saying, I'm not one of these five other people. But in a large network like the Tor network, you can't really figure out why anyone might be using it. It's a diverse network. There are a lot of diverse users. There are people like me who just use it because maybe I'm paranoid. Maybe I don't have anything to hide from, but maybe I'm thinking long term. The internet is trying to construct a story about me that I don't want to tell. So I use Tor. But maybe there's a blogger in Iran who uses Tor also because their government is really scary. Maybe there is an 8-year-old child who's using Tor. We actually have reports sometimes from parents who say, oh, I put Tor on my computer and I send all of my traffic through it for my kid. And we downloaded the latest one and it didn't work. Can you fix it? And normally we don't hear that much from these people except something breaks and then you find out, oh, there's actually this parent out here who's forcing all of their child's traffic through Tor. That's really cool. And so the larger the set of users is, the sort of, not only do you get better protection in terms of anonymity, but you also, you get better protection in terms of anonymity, but you also don't reveal why you're using something. Because if you're like part of a cancer survivor anonymity network, well, okay, so that's the anonymity network for cancer survivors? It's already giving away information about you. But Tor, nobody can really say. So anonymity loves company. The more users you have, the better your anonymity. And so this is something, very common question or concern, especially by people who are very law-abiding, upright citizens, upstanding citizens, which is that, well, bad people, don't they use Tor to do bad things on the internet? Yes. Yes, they do. Just like they use cell phones to do bad things on the phone networks, or just like they use cars to do bad things on the roads to transport bombs or whatever. Yeah, bad people do that. But the thing is that if you are a criminal, there are better solutions for you because often you only need, let's say you only need protection for 2 weeks because you're setting up some sort of, I don't know, some sort of like terrorist thing. And so in that case, the better thing for you to do is not to use Tor, which is going to be a little bit slow and maybe not provide you all the protection you want. It's going to be something like stealing a cell phone and using that to make calls. Or in one of the stories that we've heard, which I don't think is necessarily true, or at least we've been told it's not true, but it's a cute trick, is that the 9/11 bombers, one would go into a public library and go to one of the internet terminals there and type up an email in a Yahoo account and save it as a draft. And then another one would go into a public library somewhere else and log into the same account and read the drafted thing. And there would be no real way to monitor this because no email was sent. So if you were watching some email accounts for traffic between them, you wouldn't see any, right? And so maybe that's not true, but that is a cute trick that you could use if you were a criminal. I'm not advising you to do this, okay? This is not advice. But the point is that if you want cute tricks, if you want clever tricks that work in the short term for a small cell of people, then there are other solutions. Criminals are already determined to break the law. So, and oh, what happened to my arrows? You see them? And in addition to that, if you were a criminal and you really wanted to hide your identity, you would start by creating an enormous botnet, right? You would Trojan a bunch of Windows computers, you would put viruses on them, you would do exploits, you would do all of these things, and you would take control of all of these other computers and have botnets. And from there, you could do any number of bad things. The thing is that most people are not willing to do this. Most people are not criminals, but that doesn't mean that most people do not deserve the same kind of online anonymity. And so, what is the threat model when you're designing an anonymous network like Tor? Well, you have to assume that you have this user, Alice. Alice could be doing any number of things. Alice is often, in our experience, just trying to read websites that her government doesn't think she should read, or she's trying to post blog posts that her government doesn't think she should post, or she's someone who, like me, hates ad networks and hates passive surveillance that websites do, or any number of things. And so someone could be watching Alice locally. They could see, well, oh, I see, I'm monitoring her open wireless network, and I can see that she is going to the BBC all the time, or she's going to some other website, or I can see the information that she's posting on Blogspot. The attacker could be part of the network. It could be someone at your ISP, or maybe your ISP is just saving, is not only gathering information, but saving it. There are a lot of data retention initiatives being started, and some of them are being knocked down, which is good. But the point is that you can't trust the infrastructure to protect you. So someone could be monitoring your ISP traffic. Someone could be watching Bob to see what kind of information that he receives. Maybe he receives emails from Alice about setting up some sort of activist thing. You know, they're going to go have a protest. Or maybe Bob actually is the attacker. Bob could be a website that is gathering information about its users, and maybe not for obviously nefarious purposes. They could be gathering information about users just because that's what advertising networks do, for example. But they gather as much as possible. They want to know how old you are, your gender, what kind of websites you visit on a regular basis, all of these things. And they collect it and they correlate it with databases from other companies. Oh man, my arrows, you can't see them. So the simplest designs use a single relay. And this kind of sort of works in the sense that if you send the first three, Alice 1, 2, and 3, through this relay, then, you know, okay, if you're Bob 1, 2, or 3, then you can only see that it's coming from the relay's IP address, right? So that sort of works. This is what commercial proxy providers often do. But it's a single point of failure. Maybe the relay itself is evil. You know, there's a story about during the Iranian elections, a lot of people started setting up proxies because Iran was censoring its citizens. So people started setting up proxies so that they could reach things like Facebook and Twitter and post about what was going on in their country. Except the proxies were really popular, and the ones that didn't get blocked were often seeing up to like 40,000 users. And at some point, one of these proxy people said, oh my God, I can see all of their information. I'm going to shut this down and tell all of these people to use Tor, because that's a liability. Even if you're not an evil relay, that's still liability for you, because if someone says someone came from your IP address and did something bad, then that's up to you to take care of. Law enforcement might ask for logs, and it's better if you're not able to tell anyone about that. But not only that, a larger problem is traffic analysis. So if you're watching, let's say that you're watching all of the traffic coming out of your country. Let's say you are Iran and you're watching all of the traffic, and you're also, maybe they're trying to get to websites that you control. You can correlate based on timing and packets and the size of the traffic and the flow and everything. You can correlate which IPs were going to which addresses. And so traffic analysis is a very important thing. So it doesn't matter about the relay too much. Oh man, you can't see my arrows at all. All right, so this is where onion routing comes in. You add multiple relays so that you can't have a single point of failure like you would with a single hop proxy. If the first hop is a bad hop, you know, it's someone who's trying to monitor the network, so what? They know that you're talking to the first, they know that you're talking to the, they know you're using Tor basically, but that's it. That's all they don't know where you're going because the traffic between Alice and R1 is encrypted. And if you're a final hop, unless you send identifying information, they don't know where you're coming from. So what Tor does basically is separate the identity of the person from their destination. And I don't know how interested in the crypto people are. If you want to talk about crypto, we can do that later. or even better, you can read the Tor spec so that you make sure that everything comes across correctly. But basically, Alice makes a session key with the first hop, and then tunnels to R2 and R3 and so on. So how do I use this? All right. So traffic is encrypted here. It's encrypted here. It's encrypted here, but not there. What you send out of here is what you put in. So basically, if you are using unencrypted web services, then that's coming out of the exit node unencrypted as well. So if you are sending logins and passwords and stuff like that unencrypted over the internet, Tor doesn't protect you against that. That's not our thing. We take care of the network layer, and then we try to educate you about the rest. So the stuff that we spend our time on in Tor is we work a lot on performance and scalability. How many of you think that Tor is slow? Yeah, okay. So we've been working on that by increasing the capacity of the network and doing a better job of trying to figure out bandwidth and randomness. Because in addition to needing a diverse set of users, you also need a diverse set of relays. Because one of the potential attacks on Tor is that a well-funded global adversary, as we like to call it, decides that they want to control the Tor network. So what if this person decides, I have 10,000 machines that I want to add as Tor relays? Well, if they're all in one country and they're all really fast, it probably won't work that well, because Tor tries to distribute it tries to distribute the load of the relays by choosing random paths. Since there are three relays, there's the entry node, the middle node, and the exit node. And none of those can be the same. So you can't have people who maybe they can function as a guard and an exit node, but your circuit will never go through two nodes during one trip. So we work on performance and scalability. Another thing that we found was that we were maintaining the Tor software, and then we found out all of this other software had security problems. And so we started working on that, and we started providing packages for all of the different operating systems. And then we found other things that needed help. So now we have people working on a lot of Firefox extensions, contributing patches to Firefox itself, for example. We have people working on background libraries that help Tor, something like libevent. And it's probably not a thing that will scale well, but it is what we're doing. We also work on circumvention. So it's not just an anonymity tool. It's also very often used for circumvention. And it wasn't initially intended to be used for that. But just because of the design with the onion routing, it turned out to, because your traffic exits through often another country than the one you're in. It turns out to be very good for circumvention in some places. We also do basic research on anonymity. There's something called the National Science Foundation, and we have grants from them. And so we do things like metrics on the Tor network, and we have people at a lot of universities who are being funded to do studies on Tor. Advocacy, education, and trainings around the world. This one is taking up more and more time. This is things like giving a talk here and trying to kind of put a face to the Tor project, because it seems like a lot of people think that it's like ponytailed hackers in basements taking over governments or doing really sketchy things on the internet. And it's actually not. It's mostly people like me. And then the analysis, just kind of monitoring the network itself, because there aren't really many overlay networks like this. And so monitoring the network itself. All right, so this is starting to get into the circumvention stuff. So relay versus discovery. Tor has mainly focused on the relay aspect of proxying, which is where you get the onion routing stuff going on. The discovery component is how do you find all of these relays? And a lot of people in single hop proxy land have focused more on discovery components, so maybe they have clever ideas about that. But we have kept it very simple. And we have a centralized directory. There are 8 directory authorities, and once an hour, they check the status of the network, they see who counts as a relay, and then they all vote that they agree, and something called a consensus is formed. And every 2 or 3 hours, I think, a user, Alice, will download the consensus so that she is able to build circuits through all of the available relays, depending on what she's doing and where she's going. Yes?
And what if the service gets compromised?
The directory authorities. Well, so there are 8 directory authorities, and so you would have to compromise all 8 of them. If you compromise, let's say, 3 of them, which I think is probably a little bit more reasonable than compromising all 8, it will still work. We've had directory authorities go down in the past. And as long as there is a majority voting for them, they will still work. But you're right, if someone were to compromise all of the directory authorities, well, I mean, that would be a problem. I mean, to what extent, I'm not 100% sure. I haven't worked on the directory authority design. I think that they thought of this, and they have some clever trick, and I would have to check the documentation to tell you exactly. But I don't think it's that easy to compromise. Do you mean by, like, creating a new Tor? Or what kind of compromise do you have in mind? Tampering with the relay list? Like voting, like if you have 8 relays and they all vote on 2,000 new relays that are run by someone else, that are run by well, that would be really bad news. but I think it's probably an unlikely thing, but if someone were to be able to do that, that would be bad too. Yeah, for sure. And so, one of the things that we have faced with the circumvention thing is that people don't want their users to use Tor. And if you were a country and you didn't want your citizens using Tor, the easy thing would be to block all of the directory authorities, because then they could not fetch the consensus. And there are 8 IPs. They are hard-coded into the Tor source code. And nobody has used that approach yet, which is interesting, because that is probably the easiest way to block Tor. Another thing, we have a public relay list, 2,000 or so public IPs, and you could block those, which China has actually now done. China has blocked all of our public relays, and they do not let them online. You could also filter based on Tor's network fingerprint. So for example, if you're watching all of the traffic coming out of your country, you say, this looks suspicious. This looks like it's trying to do SSL, but I think I can tell that this is a Tor handshake. You could block based on that. Or you could just do keyword filtering, which a lot of people do in addition to some of these other things. We have people, for example, we provide Debian and Ubuntu packages on deb.torproject.org. And we have, I think, long known that China couldn't get to them, but even random countries that we didn't know about come into the IRC channel sometimes saying, like, I'm getting a 404 for this address, what's the problem? And we say, oh, well, keyword filtering. So we implemented something called bridges. And these are basically either semi-published or unpublished Tor relays. They kind of function like a one-hop proxy in a sense, except for they get you onto the Tor network when your country has, or when your business or wherever you work has blocked all of the public Tor IPs. And so you have a blocked user, and they send their traffic through one of these random Alices who's running a bridge. and that gets you onto the regular Tor network. So we have tons and tons of users already, and we have lots of people running relays, but instead of signing up as a normal relay, which often comes with a lot of traffic and potentially some liability, especially if you run an exit relay, you can sign up as a bridge. And we have in our Vidalia, which is our like a front-end Tor controller, there's a button you can click, just says help censored users reach the internet. It's very straightforward, very simple. All right. So that covers most of the network stuff, I think. I probably glossed over a few things, so if you have any questions, please ask me afterwards. But the network stuff is not the only problem. Application security is getting worse over time, I think. There's browsers, there's plugins, and just plain ignorance, right? People use Tor, and then they use it correctly, and they send all of their information over SSL, and they write a blog post, and then they put their full name, for example. Well, that's not really anonymous. I mean, and in some ways, that's the level of protection that you need, because you don't care if people know your real name, but you don't want them to know where you are. But I think in a lot of cases, people, they have this idea that I'm using this software and therefore I'm safe. But that's not really the case. Browsers, how many of you have seen the Panopticlick project by the Electronic Frontier Foundation? Have you heard of it? One of you? Okay. So what they did was, just through some like fancy JavaScript, they created this website that looks at basically your browser history. It gathers information from plugins like Java and Flash, which store things called supercookies. And it calculates how unique your browser is. And it turns out really unique. And maybe if you live, like I, for the past 4 years, lived in San Francisco. Maybe my browsing habits for someone in San Francisco are not unique. But what if I lived in a small town and I went to like a couple of weird websites and someone at my ISP was watching that? Or I went to a local, you know, a local news station and they were able to gather information about my browsing habits. Maybe I'm looking at things that aren't even incriminating in a bad way, but are about diseases that I may have or something like that. And so browsers can de-anonymize you at that level. But another problem is that plugins and other various applications usually ignore proxy settings. Flash and Java will both ignore proxy settings in your browser. I think you can set them per plugin, but if you just set it in your browser, it doesn't matter. In addition to that, Windows, Microsoft Office, the Word program can actually use the internet. It could, if you embed an image and put some NetBIOS calls in there, it will go out to a random website, and that website can get your IP. So that is one attack. And as I said before, plain text over Tor is still plain text. If you send information unencrypted over the internet, it exits through the exit node unencrypted. You have got to use end-to-end encryption if you want people not to see the contents of your traffic. And so there's also, I mean, JavaScript refresh attacks. As I said with the Panopticlick thing, it's pretty easy to go through and discover things like browser window size, which maybe that doesn't seem like a big deal, but if someone decides that you have done something bad and they take your computer, that's just one more thing that they're able to correlate. We have something called Tor Button, which is a Firefox extension, and it goes through and it basically rewrites large portions of Firefox, since Firefox is primarily a JavaScript thing. It goes through and rewrites large portions of Firefox to help protect you. And so at this point, you know, we recommend Tor, yes. We also recommend Firefox with Tor Button. We're working with Google to try and get Chrome to be more safe as well, because right now a lot of people don't want to use Firefox anymore. They have decided that it's not the browser for them. So they want to use Chrome, and so we're trying to help those users too. Another thing that a lot of people try to use with Tor is BitTorrent, because they think, you know, I don't want anyone to know that I'm downloading this really dirty porn or something like that. So they want to be, they, you know, or they don't want to reveal their IP address to other trackers and stuff like that. Well, it turns out you do that anyway. In addition to slowing down the Tor network, because Tor does send your traffic over Tor, but in the case where the clients are writing your IP address into the actual information that you're sending to the tracker, that's not really anonymous, is it? And in addition to that, the relays are able to watch the traffic. And if your IP is in the traffic that you're sending, well, it's not very good protection, is it? So this is something, this is a story about that, actually. Someone in the Tor IRC channel, who I guess is a Russian speaker, saw this a while ago, because a lot of people try to put forth this idea that they think, or we think, that if you use Tor, you're safe. But Tor doesn't transparently proxy all of your information. And I made a wiki page with all of the information that links to this post, so you guys can look at it afterwards, because this is only, it's like cut off at the side and everything. But yeah, so basically what happened here, if I read this correctly, is there was an abuser who was using Tor, and they were, I guess, visiting a website too. And so they, since their FTP client and the web browser wasn't going through Tor, they just sent them an FTP link, which I guess the website automatically opened an image file from an FTP link or something like that. And they got the IP address that way. So you have to be careful. It's not going to always protect you. So we went into who uses Tor a little bit earlier. But again, this is, I just like this picture a lot. So it's normal people like you and me. It's the law enforcement. It's human rights activists, business executives, military. So you see what I mean about the large pool of people and the large anonymity set. And as for the number of users, it's hard to track. We're an anonymity network. We can't keep track of these things that well. We're trying to find ways. If any of you actually study computer science, one of the things that we're doing is we're trying to find a way to better estimate how many users we have on a regular basis without de-anonymizing them. And so this is sort of an interesting research problem. But once upon a time, and maybe still to this day, Mozilla kept pretty detailed information about its extensions. And so we had the Tor button extension on Mozilla, and they told us that on any given day, there were about 450,000 people trying to update their Tor button. And so those are just people who use Tor button. There are a lot of people who are using the web without Tor button, because they just go into Firefox and they configure their proxy settings, or they go into Microsoft Windows or something. And so there are a lot of people using Tor on a regular basis. For a more rough estimate, we would say, on average, more than 100,000 and less than 1 million are using Tor right now. And so a little bit more about Tor and circumvention. So last year, 2009, there were the Iranian elections. And I don't know how big of a news story that was in Russia, but it was a really big news story in the United States. And there were a lot of people in the US who were, like I said, running proxies to try and help people get to the internet. And this is basically what happened when you can, I guess you can see, right. So you see in June it starts to build up. And then I guess they got a little bit more aggressive about filtering, and Tor started to sort of spread in popularity in Iran, and the users just, well, they didn't really go through the roof exactly, but it was about that many. And this is just on port 443. You see there was a big drop where they apparently blocked SSL in the country. And do any of you know what happened around September 25th last year? No? China blocked most of the Tor network. Apparently there was going to be like some sort of big anniversary in the country. And so suddenly what we saw was this. All of the traffic from China just went, It just dropped. This is when China fell off the internet. But remember the bridges I told you about earlier that censored users use to reach the internet? That was what happened. That's a really fun graphic to show people because, and it took, you know, so September 24th or so, it took about a week before everyone started catching on. But another thing that happened with the bridges, so China is actually really smart, and they don't like it when you do things that offend them, I guess you can say. So China figured out pretty quickly what bridges were and that people were using them. So we have something called bridges.torproject.org, which is a place that you can go and receive like a list of IPs that you can use as a bridge node to get onto the Tor network. And there is rate limiting, and depending on where you're coming from, it'll give you a different set. You know, I mean, it does use some kind of GeoIP so that you get people who are close to where you actually are. And they figured this out pretty quickly and started blocking all of those public bridges. And we said, that's okay. We have an email address, bridges@torproject.org, that people can email from a Gmail account and get a different list of bridges. And it'll only give you like 3 to 5 every 48 to 72 hours or something like that. So it took China a little bit longer to figure that one out. But eventually, they got all of the bridges from Gmail as well. And so what people are doing now, I think, is when you run a bridge, you can decide to either publish it to a bridge authority, which works like our directory authorities, except it's for bridges, or you can say, no, I'm going to publish it myself, which is where you keep the IP to yourself. We never even find out about it, but it works with the Tor software, so you can pass it out to your friends. And so another thing that we did was we knew some people in China who had, you know, very good social networks. And we said, here's a list of private IPs. Pass these out. Do something good with them. You know, you have the social network. And those actually stayed. So one person in Shanghai made a protected Twitter account and signed up 1,200 of his closest friends and just passed out bridges every couple of hours. And so those bridges saw a lot of traffic, and they very rarely got shut down. I think that there are reports now that China might be finally blocking by the handshake that we do. They might actually be able to identify us as Tor traffic. But we're not sure about that. It's hard to tell. But they are getting really, really good about blocking. And so the circumvention situation with China, we're not winning. It's a hard arms race. So that is most of the talk. In terms of what people can do if they want to help Tor, they can run a relay. If you're scared of running an exit relay, which is something that you would need to think about and be careful about, because there are smart ways to run an exit relay and dumb ways to do it. The dumb way would be to say, I have my personal computer with all of my personal information on it, and I'm going to run my exit relay from here. Because depending on your country, luckily botnets and stuff like that have at least taught law enforcement that traffic coming from a computer may not actually be coming from the person who owns the computer. So instead of banging down your door, maybe they'll knock politely. At least this is, I think, the case in Germany and the United States. I don't know about Russia. I would love more reports. So there are smart and dumb ways to run a relay. If you're going to run an exit relay, notify your ISP, tell them what Tor is. Don't run anything else on there, because you do need some level of plausible deniability if someone comes and wants to look at your stuff. In the US, the issues are going to be different than they are in other places, because we have a lot of copyright protections issues. And so we have things like DMCA notices, where someone's been BitTorrenting, and so they got a file they weren't supposed to have, you know, some like the latest, like, they downloaded the Avatar movie or something. And so they issued DMCA takedown notices because there was somebody pirating stuff from this IP. In Russia, it might be different. I don't know what the problems would be here. So that's one thing. You can also run other relays. If you have a lot of traffic, but you're a little bit nervous about what exits what exits through your node, you can run a guard or a middle relay. And a guard node is just kind of how people get onto the network. And you'll see IPs and stuff like that, but Tor doesn't log anything, and you can't tell where people are going. And so guard nodes really have very limited liability. I personally run a guard node, and I have never had any problems. And then there's the middle relays who basically know absolutely nothing about what's happening on the rest of the network. They know you came from one relay and you're going to another, and that's about it. You can also run bridges. Bridges are the kinds of things that are safe to run from your home machine. They're just, like I said, they're just hops. You're helping censored users, and they don't require that much bandwidth. So help us hack on stuff. So how many of you are programmers? Yeah, okay, great. Good, okay. So Tor has a lot of open development things going on at once. Someone emailed me, maybe he's listening to this. He emailed me about the size of our encryption keys. And right now for, let me see here. For the stream, no. We use, for the public keys for relays, we use 1024 bits, and 2048 would be better. And we would like some help sort of improving the security of Tor while also improving some of the bandwidth weighting stuff, making Tor go faster, any kind of research and experimentation people can do with the Tor network. And you know, just like general user stuff, I use on packaging. I need people who can test things, tell me where it's broken, report bugs. So there's a large number of stuff that people can do to help if you're interested in this. And if you want more specific pointers, please ask me afterwards. And so that is about it. And so now, I guess if people have questions, then I will try to answer them. Yes? Who is? Spammers? I would honestly, I don't know if spammers use Tor. I would be surprised because for our exit relays, our default, we have like a default exit policy. And an exit policy basically says what kind of traffic you will allow to exit through your exit node. So if you decide, you know, I don't want spammers exiting, then you can block like port 25 or port 587 or whatever. I mean, obviously, if people set up their mail servers a certain way, then I guess they can do whatever they want. But you can block certain ports. But it is slow. I mean, spammers often fall into, I think, like the criminal sort, who are far more likely to take advantage of innocent users' computers. We do get some reports of spam, but not that much. I think we get more DMCA notice. So I think there are more people trying to use BitTorrent over Tor than there are people trying to send spam, because it just is not, it's easier to do something else. Yes?
Am I right that you can only protect these three connections for?
Yes. Yeah, we just do TCP. Yeah, and so, and that was one of the issues with the BitTorrent thing, because a lot of BitTorrent clients use UDP, and we don't. So so the BitTorrent clients, instead of just failing mysteriously when trying to check your proxy settings, they would just keep working, but not anonymously, because they were sending your traffic over UDP, not TCP. So yeah, but that's a good point though, because we do want people to work on, there have been ideas kicked around I think for the past couple of years about getting Tor to work over UDP, but we just haven't had anyone to implement it.
Because DNS queries are sent over UDP, so these DNS
queries. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, there is, so one of our developers, Jacob Applebaum, he works on something called TTDNSD, which you might want to look into. I don't personally know that much about it, but I think that it's a way to send DNS queries over Tor. I think that's what it is. And we also have some other things, like Tor socks, that you can use random network applications with. You just say like on a command line, use with Tor, and then you know, whatever your random thing, and it will try to send all of the information. Because it's like, if you can, it's just like a SOX proxy, so it's pretty trivial to send, unless it's UDP traffic, I guess. Yes, yes.
Sorry if you already answered my question, but as you already say, if some user uses plain text protocol, Tor is not protect them against sneaky cracking.
Right.
So there is a popular technique when you can become as end road in Tor and sneak a lot of tracking.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you fight against such error modes?
Right. Well, it's hard to fight against them because so the exit node, well, so it's theoretically possible for someone who has a lot of traffic, a lot of bandwidth, and a lot of computers to become part of the Tor network. But often we find that people maybe don't do this, or try that they could take over it, right? But often people don't do this in the best way. We had, for example, we can disqualify exit nodes if we notice, for example, that they are modifying traffic by trying to like man in the middle people with strange SSL certs and stuff like that. But the monitoring thing, well, let me give you some examples of some things that happened. So a couple of, I want to say around August or so, some researchers at a university in Massachusetts in the United States brought on 500 exit nodes. So 500 is like one quarter the size of the normal Tor network. There's normally around 2,000, and 500 exit nodes suddenly appeared out of nowhere. And it was really weird because they only exited to like IRC ports, you know, and we were like, what the? And it turned out to have kind of been an accident, but we were able to notice that really quickly and lock them out of the Tor network. So that would be, so if someone were dumb about it and tried to, or we also recently, I think in October, had like 100 or so nodes appeared out of nowhere called Trotsky, a bunch of Trotsky nodes. And yeah, if someone tries to take over the Tor network and monitor traffic by becoming a majority of the Tor network like that, then we will notice it quickly and lock them out. If they do it slowly, and they do it in a really smart way by distributing all of their nodes around the world and then monitoring all of that and trying to do traffic correlation because they have guard nodes and exit nodes, and they can watch what's coming in and what's going out, that's a problem, yes. But I think that people, adversaries with that much money and that much time, probably choose a different method. But to, I think, answer your question a little bit better. So one of the issues we have is non-technical users who need to use Tor. And maybe they can't know everything about computer security. So I work on something called a Tor browser bundle, which is, it's basically like a blob of software. It's a bundled software, and it has Tor. It has the front end, Vidalia, which is, you know, very user-friendly. It has an HTTP proxy, and it has Firefox. And Firefox comes set up pre-configured with Tor button. It also, and I also started including HTTPS Everywhere, which is an extension worked on by a Tor developer and someone who works for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which forces popular websites that it knows about to use HTTPS. So in that case, for non-technical users, we try to enforce it by giving them something that works already. Otherwise, we can't stop relays from monitoring the traffic.
So you simply advise those users to use such extension or simply use HTTPS by themselves?
Yes. I mean, yeah, I mean, we tried to do what we can by educating people, but there's a lot about the internet that is fundamentally not safe. I mean, and it's not just us. It's for a long time, Facebook didn't have any kind of HTTPS. Google search didn't have HTTPS. So, I mean, what can you do if even the websites that you go to on a regular basis don't care about protecting you? I think that now, I mean, Google obviously has the encrypted search functionality now, and I think that Facebook might have it now. And so websites are catching on, and they realize that their users want to be protected, but a lot of websites don't care about keeping you safe on the internet. And there's not much we can do about that. I mean, we try to talk to people and convince them to do these things and to implement this functionality, but I mean, you know, we're an overlay network. We take care of the network stuff, and advocacy. We try to do what we can and teach smart people how to teach other people to be safe. Yes?
Is it hard to separate top traffic from the rest? Is it I will get in much many issues with top traffic being blocked on the relay or exit on bike instead of our traffic?
So the traffic itself, I mean, I think it does look like Tor traffic. Like on the front end, you can identify the handshake. You can look at the fingerprint and say, okay, yeah, this is Tor. But in terms of blocking, not that many people are blocking Tor stuff. It's mostly China right now. And other places, I think in the next year or two, we might see more because we're seeing, just in general, we're seeing more censorship in lots of countries. I mean, even places that are considered first world countries like Australia, right? They are, I think that the torproject.org website might be blocked there because they don't do any fancy filtering there, but they do keyword filtering. And so we do see a lot of keyword filtering because the filtering companies, they make these great interfaces that you can just click on a button and it'll disqualify a whole bunch of websites. And so I think Tor is often classified in the anonymizer group. And so I've had this problem even in the United States, like I'll go to a cafe to work, because you know, I'm a Tor developer, so I work from home, but sometimes I need to leave my house. And I'll go out and I need to go to the torproject.org website because that's my company's website, and it's blocked. And so I'm like, okay, so I have to use Tor to get around this cafe blocking in order to get to the Tor website. And a lot of users think that if they can't reach the website, then the software doesn't work. So I believe for a while in Iran, they were using Smart Filter, which did block. It did do this kind of keyword blocking. And so for a long time, they couldn't get to any Tor project stuff. And then Iran stopped using Smart Filter because they decided they wanted to have their own kind of filter. They wanted to do their own filtering to be able to better monitor the network. And suddenly, all these people who had really old Tor clients came back online because they were suddenly able to reach the torproject.org website again. So we see a lot more keyword filtering. I think this is also true in places like Saudi Arabia, for example. That's one of the groups of people that we get coming into the IRC channel and saying, like, I can't get to your website. I can't. Is deb.torproject.org down? Because I can't reach it. So another thing that we do in cases of keyword filtering, if maybe you live in a country where you can't get to the torproject.org website, but you can use Tor, we have what's it called? GetTor at torproject.org. And you can email it from a Gmail account, and it will send you basically one of our software packages. So you can get like the Tor browser bundle and stuff like that sent to you over Gmail. Yeah. Any other questions? Yes?
Why did WikiLeaks notify your software?
I don't know anything about that. I've heard that. But I despite the sort of commingling in the news, I don't know anything about WikiLeaks. I don't know. I don't even know if they did modify it. I don't know how they could have and still have it work. Because I know that they have a hidden service, which, do any of you know what a hidden service is? You do. OK, so we have like two people. OK, so a hidden service is basically a way to torify a web service of some kind. So let's say you have a website, and you want to enforce that people who go to it use Tor, but you don't want them to know where it's hosted. You just have, you have the service that you want to provide, and you don't want to tell anyone where it is. So Tor has an option where you can configure something called a hidden service. And it could be any web service that you want to put online. Often it's some kind of website, though. And the setup of this is very complicated, but it gives you a HTTP foo.onion address, and you can send people to it. And so WikiLeaks uses a hidden service for their submission, I believe. And so that way they can say, if you want to submit documents to us, you have to be using Tor because you can't reach the service without using Tor. But if they modified it, I don't know how they would have been able to actually still be part of the Tor network, because it does some really, because Tor actually does some really thorough checking about things like certificates, and it makes sure all of the crypto is right and stuff like that. So if they were to modify the client software too much, they wouldn't be able to get on the network. So I've heard about WikiLeaks being modified, but I don't even know if it's possible. I certainly don't know how they did it if they did. Anyone else? Oh, another one. Okay, yeah. How many? I think we do, actually. We used to have a very good GeoIP database, which did like city level GeoIP stuff. And we decided maybe that wasn't so good because, like, let's say you live in a underpopulated area in the United States or in Russia even. If there's like one Tor relay being run in Vladivostok or something like that, maybe you can identify who that is. I don't know. Or some random place in Siberia, let's say, and there's only like one hacker there. Gee, I wonder who's running that relay. So now we just do country level lookups with our GeoIP database. But there is, if you were to, so we have a metrics.torproject.org, and that can tell you more about where users are probably coming from and also where the relays are located. But we also have, in Vidalia, you can click on the network map and it will show you a picture. And so you'll be able to see all of the Russian flags. But you can also, I think, there are people who monitor the Tor network status, like websites called torstatus.blutmegi.de. And they correlate it with countries. So there, you can just line up all the Russian flags and count them. So there are a number of ways. I don't personally know offhand how many there are, but there are a number of them. And I think that we would probably like to have more of them, just because a lot of our exit nodes right now are in the United States and in Germany. And those are both pretty good countries to run exit nodes in, but it doesn't really help the randomness of the circuit creation very much. So for example, our directory authorities are also relays, and they're not exit relays because that would kind of open them up to too many chances for basically being broken into or taken. But we try, let's say, for example, Obama in the United States decides he wants to actually turn the internet off. I mean, this is something that people have been talking about, the internet blackout bill or something. Well, if all of the directory authorities are in the United States and the internet goes out, it screws all of the users. So it's like any distributed system, distributed version control, distributed peer-to-peer networks, whatever. You want to have as much diversity in the network as possible. I think there's probably at least 100 in Russia. That wouldn't surprise me if there were at least 100 here, probably in the big cities. But I would like to know more about the Russian hosting situation and stuff, if anyone could tell me that afterwards. Yes?
Can you please say if there are some recent progress
is there any progress in using Wikipedia with Tor? Is that the question?
No. Wikipedia through Tor. Wikipedia blog.
Yeah. So there are a couple of people who are working on basically ways to authenticate that you are using anonymity software without being a bad person. So I think that there are researchers looking into this, because Wikipedia, we've actually talked to Jimmy Wales, who I'm sure all of you have seen his smiling face gazing out upon you lately. But he's talked to us, and they have a problem, which is that people who deface their website are often using Tor. And so what do you do about that? And I don't know the status of that. I know that there are people who are both working on ways to sort of authenticate anonymous users without de-anonymizing them in the research, in the computer research field. And I think also Wikipedia is very interested in helping us solve this, but we don't really know how. But this is it's an ongoing problem. We have maybe not countries that are blocking people from getting access, from using Tor, but we do have a lot of websites that block Tor. And I mean, we try to educate them and show them other ways sort of to prevent spamming, for example, instead of just blocking Tor. But it's a seductive method because that's the easy way to get rid of abusive people. So, yeah, but I could probably email you some more information about the people who are doing research. Yes?
And one question. People think they don't trust them, they don't understand. So, should a person be a technical guru in order to understand and trust the problem? And so, do you know any attempt to build a VCD which could have a viral? So, it's a simple solution where you have a dedicated machine and you just plug in this component and you have a viral.
Yeah, yeah. Yes, I do actually. So there are two projects that would, maybe even three projects that would fit the bill. There's one project that we have kind of not gotten very far with called TorVM, which is meant to be like a QEMU image, which you can just put in a VM, right? And you, and then all of your traffic, it's already configured to send all of your traffic through Tor. There's also a live CD called Tails. It used to be called Amnesia, and there was another project that it was working with, but there's a live CD called Tails. It's based on Ubuntu, and it comes, I've actually tested it and it worked really well. You put it in and it works just like a live CD, but it sends all of your traffic through Tor. And I think in some cases that might be better to use than just running like even some of our packages, depending on what you're doing, depending on how you know, high risk it is or whatever. So there are those two things. What was your other question was?
Should I be a technical guru?
Should you be a technical guru to trust Tor? So the trust thing is actually kind of an ongoing discussion we have with people because people say, well, you're working on an anonymity network. You must be working for the NSA or you have spooks who are working through for you and they're trying to like, you know, trick you by putting stuff into your code. So I don't think that you have to be a technical guru to trust us. We are free software, not primarily for this reason, but this is a big reason. So someone could theoretically look at the code, and people do look at it all the time. People are constantly auditing it. There's a lot of research about it. I think that the fact that there is such a volume of information means that it is probably more trustworthy, but I don't know. I mean, how do you gauge trust about people you don't know? It's hard. So, you know, I mean, maybe you trust me, but you don't trust the people who are actually writing the software. Maybe I'm making the best packages and I'm not tampering with them at all, but. So I don't know. I mean, that's why we try to keep everything open. We keep the specs open. We keep the software, the source code open. We keep our development process open. We keep our funding open too. So every year in the United States, you have to publish basically, it's like a tax document that says, we got our money from here and we paid these people. And so we actually make those public too. So if you want, in a year or so, you can go see how much I made in 2010 and 2011, right? And so I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of information if you wanted to verify it, I think. But the other option for other proxy providers is a lot of them don't provide any information. And for some people, they think, well, if they're not providing any information to me, then they're not providing it to anyone, and therefore they're safer. But I think the opposite is true in a situation like this. If you are that worried about your safety and your anonymity, you can either trust me or you can put in some effort to go and look into it. So I don't know if that answered your question. I don't think you need to be, the point is that I don't think you need to be very technical. I think maybe you do need to be a little bit critical and interested in doing a little bit of research. But I think that would be true if you were trying to buy a house too. You wouldn't just say, well, that house looks pretty good. I'm just gonna give all my money to these people. I mean, this is your identity that you're trusting with software basically. And so I think it pays to be a little bit circumspect. And we don't mind you looking, you know? I mean, it's free and open for a reason, so. No, this is great.
Is it possible to deploy Tor infrastructure in a private network?
Yes, yes, yes it is. Excuse me?
I think somebody already succeeded.
I think that researchers do this. You can also, so some of our developers do this on a regular basis too, if they want. There's like some software called, I think, Puppetor, which basically sets up a virtual private network. But you can also, you could take the Tor stuff and go create your own Tor network. A lot of people do this for testing. It's not really good for anonymity because if the network is too small, you know, like I went over a bunch of times, if the network is too small, you don't really get any of the benefits of the large one. But people do set up virtual and real private networks with Tor, especially researchers. I haven't heard too much about, you know, random people implementing like a parallel Tor infrastructure, but I guess they could if they wanted to. Yes? Oh, wait, there's two. I think I saw him first, and then I'll get to you. Yeah. No. I think that there might be a way to get information about that, and I think that there used to be, but it turned out that that was not very anonymous. So I think we did away with the code that allowed you to find out information about that. But basically, they set up when you set up a relay, you can decide whether you want to be a rendezvous point for a hidden service, and this is far too complicated for me to even remember all the details without looking them up. But if you're a rendezvous point, you say, okay, Alice, I want you to meet me at this relay, and then from there we'll connect and I'll give you all of my private documents or something.
I just want to be curious about how to make my hidden service anonymous. The threat model that you showed us is more for end users.
Yeah. Yeah.
And when I run a hidden service, I'm connected to Tor network. And many people use it, actually. Any ISP provider can see that some node has many connections to Tor network and many connections from Tor network.
Well, I think that's the point of having a rendezvous point, is that you're not all meeting on your computer. I mean, your computer is certainly sending traffic out through Tor, and an ISP provider would be able to see that. But they're not able to see exactly where all of these connections are coming from. They would, like on a relay, if you're a relay and you function as a rendezvous point.
If there are quite a few hidden services within one country, for example, Russia,
mm-hmm.
And I'm a broker, have access to any internet exchange point, I can easily see that here we have three, for example, three sites,
mm-hmm.
Much more traffic to the Tor network and from the Tor network. Whenever points are exit or enter, the IP address actually provides the content
uh-huh.
to the hidden service
uh-huh.
has much traffic. In this case,
it is possible to agree that your node is contains the hidden service.
Yeah.
Well, but if you're running a hidden service, you're not necessarily a node. You might be just a client. It's not, the relays serve as rendezvous points, but not everyone with a hidden service is a relay.
Is it possible to provide several IP addresses, several physical machines to for the same service?
That's a really good question. I don't know. I've never encountered that question. That's a good question. I will either have to look that up for you or refer you to documentation, though, because I don't know. Because that would be cool if it were possible. Yes.
So let us imagine a couple of scenarios. Some malicious person comes up with a malicious version of Tor
mm-hmm.
and starts to distribute it all over the world or
mm-hmm.
in his country, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And this version of Tor sends information to some other malicious machine or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Thus, the Tor network has protection.
Yeah, but most of that is in the crypto. There's some very stringent key checking, because I think that's sort of one of the first kind of attacks that someone could try to do, right, is to distribute their own client information. But they would have to, I think, change the crypto in a way that the directory authorities would basically be like, no, I don't think so. You're not getting on the network. But this is another thing that I am not an expert on, so I don't want to mislead you too much. I will give you my card, and you can email me, and I will send you some information. Anyone else? Yes.
Actually, you could just kind of integrate the software on your slides, and that's it.
What do you mean? I could.
You could just publish hash on your slides. And here was the push.
Oh, I could. Yeah, I could. Well, and on the website, we do. And I personally sign all of the packages, and Roger Dingle does. You don't? Ah, okay. But do you trust my key? I mean, we sign all of the packages, and we provide, like, the signatures along with them, and we tell people how, like, here's how you verify that this package is actually from us, and we do that with the source code. So there's a trust chain. How could they get my key? Well, I have my personal key on my business card, so I can give you that, and you can have my key. But also, we have like a whole page dedicated to teaching people how to verify signatures, and on it we provide our keys. And my key is personally very well connected, and all the Tor people have signed each other's keys for the most part. And we tell people, here's where you get the key, here's how you verify the package, and if this package does not verify correctly, email us immediately and don't use it, you know, until we figure out what's going on. And so we do try to provide a trust chain. For example, I have to verify all of the software that I use in the Tor browser bundle so that I make sure that I'm not downloading like a funky OpenSSL and rebuilding it, right? Because that's a danger too. There's a trust chain involved there. I don't know how much you want to trust it by default. Depends on how paranoid you are and how thorough you are, I think. But I can go through the trust chain with you so that you can trust me. Any more questions? No? Yes? Okay.
How often you spread the word about Tor on the lecture?
How
often you spread the word about Tor?
How often do we talk to people about it? Me personally or Tor developers?
You or Tor developers?
So me personally, in November, I gave two talks. This is, I think, my only one in December so far, but it's still early. But other Tor developers are pretty much giving talks all the time. There are only about 10 of us, and I think per month we probably do between 5 to 10, sometimes more, per month. So there are a lot of people who want to talk to us. Like I said, some of the more senior developers go and talk to people like at the FBI, and they talk to police officers in Germany and stuff like that, because not only do we want to teach them how to use Tor to sort of increase the diversity of the network, but we also want to teach them what Tor is so that they don't go breaking down people's doors. And so they do understand that it's not just this thing that's thwarting them from catching criminals. It's something they can use too, and there are other methods that they can use besides locking people out of using it. We talked to lots of activists, lots of non-technical people. I went to Global Voices. Global Voices is a citizen journalism network, and they had a conference in Chile, and I went there, and I talked to a bunch of bloggers and stuff like that, because bloggers, like I said, they used to just be sort of these irrelevant narcissists on the internet, and now they're reporting about bad stuff happening in their country, and they need protection. So Tor people, yeah, I have to function both as like a developer and someone who goes and talks to people and tries to convince them. But I'm a little bit more new to it than other Tor developers, so I'm still learning. Yes? Can wait. Oh, export restrictions.
Like,
Oh, I see. Okay, yeah. Right. So in the United States, which is, you know, the jurisdiction I know the most about, the United States, I guess, apparently said recently to some big companies like RIM, who makes BlackBerry, they said, you got to backdoor your software. All of this crypto is making it really hard for us to monitor our citizens, so you have to backdoor it. Nobody has asked us to backdoor it yet, and if they did, then we would tell them to bugger off, basically. But it's a worry, because Tor does have strong encryption in it, and we do have to deal with the export license. We're in the process of trying to get an export license, because we're not technically allowed to let users download our software in places like Iran or, you know, whatever the axis of evil, quote unquote, the U.S. has decided exists right now. So we're currently trying to get an export license because, yeah, our crypto is too hardcore. And somehow we don't qualify for the free software exception that they have, nor do we qualify for the mass market commercial software because we're free. So we're so it's an interesting problem that we're having with the export restrictions.
Okay, I think it's time to finish our talk.
Okay. Thank you, everyone. Thanks.